Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Salter Street Brewery, one of the beer havens in Toronto's East End. You can visit Salter Street Brewery just south of Queen Street East in Toronto near Broadview. They have limited parking, or just get off the 501 streetcar at Queen and Salter. The company is made up of a small, passionate team of beer lovers. All the beers are made right there on site. Riverside Pilsner is the flagship Salter Street beer, but they have a really good tap list right now. Riverside available at LCBOs, beer stores, and some grocery stores. It's got a great cottage vibe on site. Enjoy the great beer there, or take some fresh beer to go in their hand-filled howlers or their tall boy cans. Salter Street Brewery, a perfect stop on your East End Toronto beer tour. Dog-friendly, available for private events, and features live music on select Saturdays. It's open noon to 9 p.m. every day. Go and visit salterstreetbrewery.com or check them out on Instagram or Facebook. That's at Salter Street Brewery. Okay, last one. Good day. Greetings. Hello. It is Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. My name is Mark Wigmore. Welcome to episode 10, our final episode here in this first season, and today features someone who fits under all the titles I just mentioned. I've known her for a long time. She's someone I've known of even longer, an artist, a cultural thinker, a media personality, actress, musician, performance artist. Sukhyun Lee is on the podcast today. And if you are listening on a Thursday, you now have four more chances, I think it's four, to see her new hybrid documentary theater show, Unsafe, which unpacks many examples of censorship in the modern age and even reflects on older examples, especially from the art world. She really puts it all out there with this particular piece. It's a Canadian stage production, and it's on until Sunday at the Berkeley Street Theater, which I understand has a new name. I'm not totally familiar with it yet. Many of us will be calling it the Berkeley for the foreseeable future. Sukhyun has everyone talking with this thing. Literally, there are talkbacks right after the show is over. People are discussing it on the street. Critics are polarized on its ability to transcend. I was convinced. More on Sukhyun in moments. Art at the End of the World is brought to you by Red Eye Media, an innovator in arts communications and media relations for over 15 years. Red Eye Media works with leading film, television, and performing arts organizations to build their audiences and their impact through engaged, passionate, and strategic communications. Those organizations include Canadian Stage, Crow's Theatre, The Musical Stage Company, Pacific Northwest Pictures, Summerworks Performance Festival, and the Toronto Dance Theatre. For more information on the power of Red Eye, visit redeyemedia.ca. So, I'm going to try and keep it short and sweet today. I want to start by thanking our sponsors, Red Eye, Salter Street, Superframe, and Kerner Hall at the RCM. We could not have done this first season without you. This was as much a vote for the arts and for this type of programming and this type of a podcast as it was a broadcast to get the word out about you. So thank you so much. And also to my loyal Patreon supporters, thank you. You were a tight bunch, but it meant so much to me to know that I had a few bucks at the beginning of this thing and that I could pay for website fees and SoundCloud fees and web support and overhead. So thank you very much. It really did help push this idea forward. And as you can imagine, I'm a bit of a one-man band. I'm a one-man band no matter where I go, it seems. And I have to update the website, artattheendoftheworld.com, the SoundCloud site, the social media. And just looking over this last 3 months of episodes, this last 6 months of work, I am very proud. I am proud that this was able to happen. No matter what, wherever it may go from here on out, we set out to talk about artistry and the complicated world around us right now, and more or less, that's what we did. 20 episodes or so with the bonus round extras. I'm thrilled. It was great to be able to scroll over the photos and listen back to some of the audio. And it was important to have this conversation. And I really do believe that. And we chipped away some of the rough rock on this show. We whittled down and tried to get to some answers here. So thank you to all the guests, all available, by the way, to listen to at art@theendoftheworld.com. And I think a lot of people will be coming to this podcast just as we are wrapping up season one here. And that's great. I mentioned them earlier, Art at the End of the World, brought to you by Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory of Music, a beautiful room, and reminding you that it is Kerner Hall's 10th anniversary concert season, and also that tickets for the exciting 11th season are on sale now. Every season, there are nearly 100 spectacular concerts by the world's top classical, jazz, roots, and world music artists. I know because I've talked about them on multiple radio stations that I've worked at. Kerner Hall, one of the finest concert venues in the world, no matter who is performing. See the lineup at rcmusic.com/performance. Okay, so Sukhyun Lee. I first saw her, like a lot of Gen Xers and boomers and maybe people older or younger, what have you, on Much Music, of course. She was a fascinating addition to the VJ lineup. And interestingly, her boss then is my boss right now, Moses Neimer. She'll tell you the story, but he saw that she was this unique voice and an artist. And he introduced her to Canada and beyond. And how many zany ideas and experiments did she attempt as a VJ on Queen Street West on Much Music? A lot. Her interviews with musicians, very memorable, and we'll talk about a couple of those during our conversation. She really pushed the boundaries with her explicit film Short Bus. I know it was difficult for her bosses at CBC when that film came out. Nudity and sex revolving around your host is tricky. But I think that film tells you a lot about Sukhyun Lee and what she's trying to do out there in the media, in the art world. And mentioning the CBC there, that is where Sukhyun Lee and I met, in the hallways. And she was always very approachable and always seemed to have a bit of time for a conversation, which was great. Because I was just this guy who worked with Rich Turfry. You know, she didn't need to talk to me. So I always had this really great experience chatting with her. She was the host of Definitely Not the Opera for many years, and she was an important voice within the CBC, not only as an artist and as a thinker and a host, but as a Chinese Canadian. And certainly the topic of diversity and who gets to tell stories within the art world is a big part of her new Canadian stage show. Most of all, though, I admired Sukhyun for a long time as someone who wasn't afraid to get into the public realm and stir up the pot, poke the bear. Even if she didn't have all the answers or know exactly how it was all going to go. She reminds me a little with what she does of some of David Byrne's experiments. David Byrne of the Talking Heads. I once watched him give a talk about his public art experiments. And she really does live in the same world. She's just trying to see what's going to make people react. What's going to get people talking? So when I saw Unsafe at Canadian Stage, I knew that Sukhyun Lee had to be the final episode guest of season one. She is addressing the voices within art, the changing power structures, the idea that installing diversity into the arts is hard work, that it's messy. She looks at how young people are feeling about art, about censorship. The idea of reverse colonialism is brought up in the show. Appropriation, gender, sex, our tendency to speak to each other only in digital terms in 2019, and the power of being together to experience art, really together. Right? I had to speak with her. This is the whole show. So here it is, the final episode of season one. This is my conversation with Sukhyun Lee.
It must be a bit weird coming
so
to this
cute.
To this
like,
place
Genia.
Because there's a whole bunch of people here from your old days.
Yeah, I bet.
Like lots, I think.
Oh my God, Moses is like this father, the father figure.
He's
like,
the Lorne Michaels of sort of this, you know, city, Much Music.
He's so sweet.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And he came to your show.
He did
last night.
Yeah.
I'm so excited that you're here. Sukhyun Lee on the podcast, and this is an interesting moment because I saw your show the other night, Unsafe, and I thought to myself, this is only perfect that the end of season one, Art at the End of the World, comes to a conclusion with you, because everything that I've tried to talk about on this podcast over the last 3 months has something to do with your discussion in your play.
Ah, fantastic.
And so I'm so thrilled that you're here. I would imagine, similar to your show, it's hard to even know where to start because everything is tipping.
Yeah.
Everything is up in the air.
It's a swirl. Somebody in the audience, we do a talk back every night, and they were like, yes, I'm just ingesting this swirl. I'm like, I like that description.
And there's good things happening and bad things happening. Up is down, left is
sideways,
right.
Bonkers.
It's a crazy time, right?
It is. It's very an intense time. A lot of upheaval, but a lot of potential, a lot of possibility, and a lot of possibility of horrible things as well.
Right. And no wonder you, as you know, I experienced your piece the other night. There's so many directions you can go, and it is hard to find the way forward through it all because there's so much to unpack, so much to discuss.
A lot of confusion and anxiety in our current cultural moment to unpack.
Yeah. It seems that no matter what I do, there's no avoiding seeing you naked running around. Mm. That seems to be part of Sookian's deal.
Sometimes, yes. I mean, I remember my very first naked job was when I was a teenager in Vancouver.
Oh, wow.
And that was, you know, I was living on my own since I was 15 and trying to make some money, and I posed for art classes.
Okay.
And that is a really tough job, posing for nude art classes.
Very still.
Well, very still. I remember going up, you know, they just call you, you got a gig here. You go to, you know, a high school on a Sunday in the basement. And you walk in and there's like all elderly people at a art class, and you sit on a little stage and stand there, you know, sit there holding a pose for like over an hour. That is so hard. My limbs would fall asleep. And then afterwards I'd go around and see people's paintings, and there I was, a green blob in one.
Right.
Very interpretive.
I
often use nudity in a way that is very plain Jane. Like, it's very much like matter of fact how you walk around in your bathroom, as we all did this morning and sat on the crapper, you know. But
that's how it felt in this current show too.
Pretty just much taking your clothes off,
right,
putting them back on, sitting down, moving around. So it's not for necessarily erotic titillation. It's just like, I do find the naked body is an interesting tableau, metaphorically, literally, that it does. It's raw and vulnerable and naked as you are.
Right.
So I really love that. And it also...
You feel comfortable doing it?
I mean, it never does. Like, I always sort of go, oh, don't.
Because from my experience, I think, okay, well, there I was. I had my singular experience. I walked out of the theater that night and I'm left with that experience. Yeah. And then I thought to myself on my way here today, well, Sookian has to do that every... Every night. That just is part of her routine
now. And I kind of go, okay, sometimes twice a day.
Right.
Desmond Cole, a phenomenal journalist and activist, came to see the show. And he was like, you did a magic trick there. Because he was like, I was looking at the stage and you were naked. At first he was like, woo-woo, woo-woo. And then he was like, so what? That's no big deal. Like, the next second he was like, yeah, that's whatever. That's a body. At first I was like, taken aback, and then I was like, matter of fact. And so it should be. And I mean...
And relatively quickly, too. I found that, too, that I got there very quickly. I'm like, okay, well, here we are.
You know what?
Yeah.
On the set of Short Bus, the movie that was a sexually explicit film that I acted in, I was very nervous to take my clothes off for the first, you know, naked scene. And so what I did was I demanded that everyone in the room, including all the crew, everybody, take their clothes off, too. And we cranked up the stereo and moved around and danced around like goofballs.
Right.
And it quickly demystified any body taboo. And it was very, very normal. After all, I was like, could you please put your clothes back on? So I do use nudity, but also it's also symbolic. There's a couple of times that I appear naked in the show. One is when we reenact and recreate a famously censored painting, classical painting of a naked woman at a beach, at a picnic. But again, it's a different thing there where it's like the woman, again, taking the risk, being naked, bearing all, putting her ass on the line, surrounded by men who are clothed and pointing at her. So it becomes also, it sort of, the symbolism inverts itself as well.
I do like that idea that anxiety around it evaporates.
It does.
In some of these experiences.
So long as we can talk about it. And I think that has been my compulsion. I mean, the show is all about, it began as a sort of investigation into art and censorship. And then as I began to utilize my journalistic skills to interview various artists, I realized that much of them have been muzzled, silenced, excluded. The ideas that they wish to talk about were too risque by cultural institutional standards, and they were kiboshed. And I do feel that it's really important to talk about these things in order for us to get more of a beat on what it exactly it is that we're afraid of, and perhaps overcome that fear.
Even just to stir it up.
Yes, totally.
There's nothing else.
There's a gazillion ideas in this thing. I think everybody walks out kind of going, talking to their friends quite a bit. Like afterwards, I was going to the bus stop last night and I came across a group of people still debating based upon what they had just seen.
I think you've done a great service. I really enjoyed the show and I tried to go in with an open mind, and I have a little bit of context for you. We've worked together, or at least in the same building at CBC, and so we've talked a little bit, but I thought, okay, I'm just going to be open. And of course, there's moments where I'm thinking to myself, okay, you know, I'm uncomfortable here, or this is pushing me or triggering me or whatnot. And, but at the same time, by the time I walked out, I had a lot to think about. And that's about as much as you can ask.
I hope for utility in my work.
Yeah.
And this one was particularly a passion project because there were so many obstacles in trying to do it. I encountered a lot of, you know, resistance.
And we learn about that in the show.
I talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of obstacles that it almost did not come to pass. And I was literally writing it still, like, as we went to the stage.
People use the word organic a lot, but I feel that that term really does apply to this piece. I mean, you really are kind of making it up as elements come your way, whether an interview was finished or
somebody pulled out.
Or somebody decided they didn't want to be a part of it, or the
Canadian stage itself saying we think we're going to cancel it.
And we learn all about that in the experience of seeing it. And I think that I would imagine that type of storytelling has been done in some format before. For me, it was quite unique. And I really admired that.
Well, it's, you know, once I encountered the people and their stories and their accounts of being censored and silenced and excluded, I just rooted for them. And I felt like I needed to finish the project for them, because literally it was like, okay, we're going to either kill the piece or bump it to 2 years from now. When they say they're going to bump it, like, I could shine it to a gem, but in 2 years, the conversation's going to be done. Everyone's already have talked about
it. Or different, at least.
Yeah, different.
Yeah.
But it's crucial to facilitate this conversation now, so I pretty much use my will to muscle everyone, shove it on stage, just out of sheer utility, knowing that maybe we just got to be able to be okay broaching some of these difficult subjects.
You mentioned compulsion a little earlier, and I'll mention a couple of memories I have of you, and hopefully we can go back a little bit to dig into that. But let me just look. Oh, okay. Well, this is one that you actually bring up in the show, and this is you on when you were a Much Music VJ. I think that's how a lot of people came to know who you are, and then, of course, with DNTO on CBC and on, and various other high points on the seismograph of your career. But you point out the piece that you did where you were dead on Queen Street West.
On Much Music.
You just lay there on the pavement.
Much Music was the best job in that it was my first job, first legit official job. And Moses Neimer, who heads up Classical FM, still now radio maker and magazine maker.
Yeah.
Idea.
Still a TV man, too.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Visionary. He pretty much, his hiring practice was whoever ignited his curiosity and interest. And some of my video and music work came his way. And he was like, who is this kid? Get her. Do you want a job? He hired me. Like, I was living in Vancouver and he was interested in my work and just went, okay, you on. And I'm like, you know what? I am not a supermodel. I'm not going to be able to read teleprompter. I want to speak my mind. He's like, yes, 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 and yes. And so that was my first job. I moved to Toronto, and there were hours to fill as a Much Music VJ. People still recognize me.
Sure.
And they say stuff like, oh, yeah, remember that time you showed us how to relieve trapped gas?
Yeah.
All you have to do is put your bum in the air, high point, put your bum in the air because hot air rises. There are so many things that I've just filled the time with. So the whole building was surveyed. There were cameras on every corner. And such a great team. And one day I said, hey, let's go outside, take their surveillance cameras, point them at me, and I'm going to lie down on Queen Street as if I were dead. And let's see what happens. Let's see what happens to Torontonians.
I think it predates maybe the Michael Moore, because he did something similar an actor,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I predate Michael Moore for sure.
Because he did a similar experiment, but I think you did it first on Much Music. So how about that?
Yeah.
And people did not come to your rescue.
They did not give two poops.
About you being perhaps dead.
There was one person who stepped over me.
Yeah.
I remember waiting for the TTC at that exact intersection at Queen and John, not with the cameras on. It was the dead of winter, and there were two people. Do you remember that men's suit shop?
Sure.
That used to be there?
Yeah.
Fancy men's suit shop. Two people, F-U-K-I-N-G.
Yeah.
In the little alcove of the doorway.
Really?
Yes. And we were just still like,
what are we, New York City in 1971? What's going on here?
It was so hilarious. Nobody was saying anything. There is a silence as the two people were grunting and groaning. And that's nothing compared to what was happening in Speaker's Corner.
Right.
Like the outtakes that they would show at Christmas, our staff Christmas
80%
party.
80% not showable. In Speaker's Corner. I remember people making the trip just so they could, you know, do something in Speaker's Corner, right? Making the trip from all over Canada and so on. So there was that, and you show a little piece of that in your performance piece, your play. The other one I remember is you playing this tiny little piano with Tom York from Radiohead.
Casio.
You remember that?
Yes, I do. And I regret it because he admired my tiny retro Casio so much I gave it to him. I was like, oh, I learned how to play drums on that, listening to the snare on that Casio tone.
I just remember you guys kind of jamming, and maybe it was a New Music episode, perhaps?
Yeah, it was when Kid A came out, and it was a special for Kid A. So Tom York and I, as soon as we met, we hit it off very well. We're like both sort of mischievous elf people. So we kind of recognized each other very quickly on. He was very, like most English musicians and post-punks, kind of like suspect of the media.
Yeah.
And so there was something that was a breath of fresh air coming into like unscripted Much Music in its heyday before VJs were scripted.
Sure.
We just sort of got along very well. So whenever they would come into town, we would make a point of visiting and hanging out and stuff. And it came to such a point where, you know, I would see him within an interview context so frequently, we would try to challenge ourselves to figure out a new way to energize the interview experience for us.
I'm sure he appreciated, or other people, many people, I'm sure appreciated that.
Yeah, so that one took place entirely in my home. We did another one in Oxford where we were like, oh, what can we do now? And then we were like, okay, why don't we just go back to back in the same room and not look at each other? And it was a very interesting one because it was very kind of subconscious feeling, very kind of like, very revealing. Turn down the lights a bit, but go back to back, not look at one another, but feel each other's presence in the room. So we were always kind of like playing experiments. And I think that has been a consistent aspect of my work from early teen times growing up in Vancouver and dressing up as a 10-foot egg noodle, Mr. Noodle, to walk around the streets of Vancouver to see what would happen to me. I was beaten up by a gang of skinheads. And I made that into a movie. That was my first movie. So this idea of experimentation and lying on Queen Street, pretending I'm dead, doing unsafe, throwing that experiment in the works, I think that's something that really drives my curiosity.
I'll share one other experience, and this actually was Paul Templeman.
But he was at the CBC for a bit.
Yeah, he was at the CBC too. Yeah, and so he says hello, but he reminded me that you attempted to reclaim the C word while interviewing the Red Hot Chili Peppers, much to the chagrin of Denise Donlan. And I know how that goes. I've made her mad with swear words too.
My God, that's so funny. Okay, so what happened was I was interviewing the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The previous time they had been at Much Music was a debacle because I think Erica M was interviewing them, and their conversation turned to sex toys, and she was extremely uncomfortable about the conversation and kind of got very upset. So they were like, oh, we're going to put them on a timer.
Those guys could play pretty dirty pool back in the 80s and early 90s.
That is so true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, so when I heard that what happened, I was like, I can talk about sex toys till the cows come home. I'll do the interview, no problem. So we do the interview, and, you know, like most post-punks, you have to kind of scrap with them a bit for you to win their respect.
Sure.
Or else they're just going to, like, slay you on air. So we were in a commercial break surrounded by kids and stuff, and Anthony Kiedis notices my ring, a handmade ring made by my friend Marina. It's a beautiful silver ring.
Right.
She gave it to me when I left Vancouver to move to Toronto to do the gig. It's included words that were our power slogan. And am I allowed to say the word here? Can you?
Sure, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So our saying was cats, cunts, and rubber cocks. Because it was all we ever talked about when we got together. I even wrote a song that's like, cats, cunts, and rubber cocks, cats, cunts, and rubber cocks.
It's my ringtone. Yeah, I got that on here.
You're my best friend. So it was always an endearingly lovable thing. It was a power slogan for us. It never occurred to me that it was this a swear word. So, you know, I explained it to him and he was like, that is so cool. And I'm like, let's wait until we're on air and we can talk about it. So we go on air and I talk about it.
Now, you did not have some sort of filter in your mind saying that this might be a problem.
I really loved this word.
Right.
And so I, you know, we talked about it for quite some time.
Okay.
And then I saw, you know, the floor director hold up a sign, change the topic. And me being a person who often reveals, you know, breaks down the fourth wall,
right,
as Moses is encouraged us to do.
Right.
I'm like, oh, and now they're holding up a sign. Change the topic. We have been talking about it for a long time. So, okay, let's go on to the next question.
Right.
And it went
great. So respectful, but also showing us.
Showing us the process.
The reality, yeah.
The reality. Everyone's having a great time. The kids are having a great time. The band, me too. It's like awesome. And then as soon as, you know, it's over, I get a very stern look from Denise Dolan. I'm like, what? That was great.
Yeah.
She's like, we put them on a 20-minute warning. We didn't think it would be for you.
Right.
Don't you know that the C word is a swear word? And I was like, oh, right.
the artist.
I can understand that that could be used very derogatorily, but I only ever used it in an empowering way.
Right.
It's a strong word and it's a powerful word.
There's a strong argument that you could do that, have that conversation again. I mean, you know, that's still a relevant thing you could do to this day, you know, with that particular word.
Words are powerful.
They are.
And it's so interesting it would be much more interesting if we could unpack that word.
Right.
You know, instead of
right. It's just a write-off. We just don't do that.
It's just like Mark Twain. Let's remove all the N-words that he uses so that we can scrub them from the history books as if that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's really the way to do it.
It's not helpful.
It's not useful to our kids to not know the history and not know what happened. We won't learn.
So speaking of kids, were you raised in Vancouver? Or?
I was raised in North Van.
North Van. That's okay. So I'm a Victoria kid.
Oh, I was a Lynn Valley kid.
Right. And so,
there's a Satan Fest in your
There's a lot.
They're very well organized.
Well organized Satan Fest, huge ska fest. They have some very unique festivals in Victoria, but so North Van, kind of suburbs, I guess.
Tiny town.
Yeah.
By the mountains. When I grew up there were a lot of headbangers, a lot of like shit kicking. In Dayton boots.
Right.
And like, you know, we'd go to the park.
Getting smokes.
And there'd be like a bunch of headbangers sitting on our seesaw. We're like, darn, we can't go on the seesaw. The bigger people are there and they're smoking and drinking Jack Daniel.
Right. Brothers, sisters? Or?
Yeah, I had three sisters.
Okay.
So Chinese Canadian family. My parents are first gen Canadian. Or actually, I'm first gen. They were immigrants.
Right.
And grew up in a pretty secluded, sort of working middle class neighborhood, but not. It was like me and Bev Wong and my sisters were the only Chinese kids in the in you know, the radius of 50 miles. So yeah,
and all that entails in the 70s and 80s.
Yes, that's right.
It's a different experience.
Yeah, very marginal.
Than now, I
would
think.
Very alienating, but also I had a very strict family,
mm-hmm.
so just spent a lot of time watching TV. and like being, you know, trying to achieve all A's at school and stuff. So very strict family. And then it all sort of broke to hell when you know, my parents couldn't keep it together anymore. And they ended up having a very toxic divorce. And I took that possibility of escape at 15. So I ran away from home when I was 15.
You ran away.
Yeah. So I ended up just kind of going from a very, overprotected space.
Yeah. Structured, routined.
And also kind of nuts because my mom was really, really wrestling with some major mental difficulties, mm-hmm. being a housebound housewife, alienated from her family and culture and trying to raise kids that she didn't necessarily want. So there was a lot of rage there.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was a pretty, quite a bit of upheaval in my family. And in Chinese families, people really don't get divorced. So it was quite dramatically horrible enough for them to actually go, let's leave.
It really is amazing that people do as well as they do, isn't it?
They really
when
do.
When you think about it.
I mean, when you think about both of my parents,
recipe.
My mom surviving the Cultural Revolution, my dad being an orphan at war, one gen, and here I am living such a privileged life compared to them. But still, their move to Canada was fraught and difficult, trying to fit in here. And then so, yeah, when my family collapsed, I just took off. And
egg noodle.
I became an egg noodle walking the streets of Vancouver. No, I ended up just like embracing arts, which I was always forbidden to take.
Okay.
And I was a very shy kid. And I ended up just entering a lot of contests, writing plays, expressing myself in painting, making videos and films. And then suddenly I'm like living on Dyke Row in Vancouver in an enclave of artists and lesbians who became like my extended family, who were so hugely influential on my younger self.
And your mind and everything is so malleable at that point that there is an ability. If you've got it in you, you can go with the flow.
Well, you always do. Every child does. Every child, like,
was raised by some, I wasn't quite that way.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
You might not think it, but man, those, you can tell with a kid, you know, I'll go up to a kid and I'll speak Cantonese, uh-huh. and they'll be able to say it back to me very, very pitch perfect because their rigidity of language isn't so formed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of the time, the lives of children are full of upheaval and torment, and yet they kind of roll with it. You know, so maybe when you were really young, when you were 5, you had elasticity. Although, Mark, I think you're maybe more elastic than your exterior demeanor
right.
suggests. Oh, you're a bit stealth. I mean, you hang out in Algonquin Park, for goodness sakes.
That's true. For months on end. Yeah, that was
only
how
the malleable do that.
Only the malleable. We'll use that word. Still, mom, dad, sisters still in the picture, or
my sister and I were street kids, and she passed away. My sister Dee Dee in her young life.
Wow.
And so, yeah, there I am aware that there are real consequences for young people, and yeah, it was very.
You can roll with it to a point.
You roll with it how you can. I mean, it still feels very heavy to me. I mean, I was her surrogate mom when we both left.
Oh,
and so I was also just too young to take care of her, but I still feel tremendous amount of guilt for not being able to raise her as well as I could. So, but yeah, so that was super difficult and stays with me for a long time.
How are you with the baggage? I have my good days and my bad days.
I feel that the baggage has informed who I am. I think the baggage and the obstacles and the challenges of life has entirely fueled me, and specifically the difficult relationship with my mom. My mom, I don't know where she is. She's MIA, and she's a very turbulent person. She's kind of like Callie, the goddess of destruction. She will fuck your shit up. She
right.
will kill you.
Right.
And right now, I just think it's really hard for her to be around people because she immediately turns them into the hostile person that she must kill. And
right.
so, yeah, there was a point where I was the only person in the family talking to her. Everyone was like, don't do it. Because she just seems to be unable to do that. And so, you know, I did have to strike, you know, set my boundary when she started again being very difficult with me. And I just said, hey, if you're going to treat me that way, I can't really do that. So you're sort of inviting abuse. And so she was like, see ya. So
funny.
I don't know where she is right now.
It's amazing how those dynamics continue to be reframed and reframed and reframed as we leaf through the chapters of our own life.
Thank God for art.
Yeah.
Because I do think that primal conflict of the person I love the most sort of transforming into this other sort of hostile entity, I think really gives me insight into humans and desire for connection, love, and also acceptance of the tumult and conflict. The baggage to me is kind of extraordinary. The tears are, they're sacred.
Well, it gives weight to something you experience too. That's why a piece of theater for somebody who's, you know, emotionally somewhat mature, you can go to something and be truly affected by it because it's affecting your own conversation.
You know? Our lives are challenging. I don't know anyone who doesn't have those difficulties.
More with Sukhin Lee in moments, but a reminder, Art at the End of the World brought to you by Superframe. Superframe offers custom archival framing with a mandate to enhance and protect artwork, but not compete for attention with that artwork. As an art-focused frame shop, Superframe only offers the highest quality frames and materials. They specialize in custom milled hardwood moldings, which they finish in a wide range of stains and lacquers. They mill and stock their most popular profiles in quantity to ensure the fastest possible turnaround, but also are able to design any custom profile with just a little notice. Superframe offers water gilding and photo framing, and their services include professional installation, transportation, and display systems. Visit superframe.ca to find out about all the services offered at Superframe, and you can make an appointment there as well to visit their workshop at 100 Geary Avenue in downtown Toronto. Superframe, check them out at superframe.ca. So let's get back to the conversation. I don't really need to reframe this for the purpose of our Art at the End of the World theme because we're talking about the themes during the entire conversation. So let's get back.
Your show is called Unsafe, and you bring up a lot of different elements of censorship, and it speaks to so many of the ideas that we've tried to unpack here on this program. And you give examples of perhaps things that have been censored wrongly for a long time, or maybe ideas that are by a large group of people that were always considered to be taboo. But maybe we need to, you know, be looking at both sides of the coin here. And I was reminded as I watched your show of an experience I had when I worked at 103.9 Proud FM, which is an LGBT-focused radio station. I was there for 3 years, and so I got a lot of experiences that a straight white guy doesn't get to have. Mm-hmm. For one thing, I was in the minority for the first time in my life in that situation. I went to a big kink party while I was there, and I didn't know anything about that. I didn't even know what I should dress up as or do anything. I dressed up as Indiana Jones. That's how crazy I was. I just treated it like Halloween. I was like, okay, I'm just going to do what I want to do, you know. And I remember the guy I was with. Yeah, right. And so at least I had a whip, you know. So, but the guy I was with, Sean Prue, who is a host in this town and a media guy, he said, I was so worried, but you actually looked kind of cool amongst all the people. And it was a huge party. And there were people, you know, men with big beards dressed as Little Bo Peep. There was one woman who had Icarus wings literally jammed into her back, and she was bleeding down her back.
Wow.
It was an incredible experience. And there was a dungeon, and there was all types of oddness going on. And I turned one corner, and I saw about four or five guys dressed up in SS Nazi uniforms, complete with all the medals.
Sure.
Complete.
Very fetishized look.
Yeah. There you are. So it was a fetish party. And they also had these sort of ice blue contact lenses in to really complete the look. And it really stuck with me. I thought, this is one of the most strange, you know, images I've ever stumbled upon. They're real. There's a motivation there. I remember hearing Lemmy from Motorhead talk about how he really loved all that, the look and feel of all that gear as well. And I've been struggling.
Very powerful, quote unquote.
Yeah. I've been struggling with how
Kaczynski used to dress as a military sergeant and immediately would be able to go to the front of bank lineups.
Right.
Prince Harry dressed as a Nazi.
He did.
A Halloween party thing. God, was like roasted for that.
That was tricky as a royal.
This kink party, what year would it be?
So we're looking at 2009. So mm-hmm. It's not lost on me that that's 10 years ago. And
things
that was
change.
They do.
Yeah. Now you wouldn't be able to do that.
I don't think
just
so.
It's like you can't walk around wearing a headdress.
No.
Like a lot of people used to do that. Like,
it's fascinating how Gwen Stefani went through she really got to break through the coals through her various appropriations over the years. Just over this last year, because of course everybody's looking back to the 90s and her and saris yeah. and various, you know, right. you know, other elements of Asian
yeah,
culture.
Time does change in different, like I did find in making Unsafe, looking at art and censorship, I wanted to look historically, like the diving point that we were commissioned with was the idea of the Eli Langer case from 25 years ago, a painter who was accused of depicting child's pornography in his paintings. He mm-hmm. went to trial. He was arrested. The gallery curator was arrested at the Mercer Union Gallery. The charges were dropped because many people in the arts community came to the fore and said it's a work of art and it didn't fit the criminal code of child porn. So it was thrown out. And so it's very difficult to try art in the court of law. It's a big waste of taxpayers' money. It just doesn't work out.
Right.
But that does not mean the idea of controlling has gone away. And as I was uncovering more instances of artists being censored and what have you, it became very clear that it's more in the domain of exclusionary practices, silencing, and like the question of who gets access to the media and who gets heard. Those types of ideas running into a disability activist artist who experienced an incredibly confrontational and silencing interaction with the Art Gallery of Ontario. And, you know, speaking with Leila Benbrook was part of an Arab-Canadian art exhibition that was canceled by the Canadian Museum of History after 9/11 due to insensitivity concerns. You know, these things started to repeat. And even the TTC being involved in this particular site-specific public artwork now that costs $2 million. It's called Lightspell, and it's about, you know, a light board that you can write what you want while you're waiting for the subway. And now they're worried that it's going to be used for hate speech, so it's not yet been turned on. So it sits there in limbo. Up until, you know, so many instances of musicians decrying the fact that they have to pay expensive submission fees to be eligible for a music award, which really puts the Junos in every single huge award show in perspective when you realize, oh, all of them have paid so much money to get in
right.
that who's left the gate, the gatekeepers keep the poor out. It's class. So just these kind of interesting things started to bubble up. And so, that is all context.
It's disorientating.
It is.
It's a lot.
It makes us question our biases, our systems that we construct. That are supposed to, they're paid by the taxpayers and they should reflect people more.
Yeah.
But when you realize that all of our cultural, in all of them, including the CBC, the, you know, AGO, the National Gallery, Canadian Stage, who is putting this thing on, all upper management is white. That's a specific lens. And so I think the piece begins with an extraordinary interview with Matthew Jocelyn, the former artistic director of Canadian Stage.
I was just going to bring it up, and you dive into the idea of checking boxes.
Yeah.
Was I hired to check a box?
And he's like, I'm a 6-year-old, totally entitled white guy who grows up in the classical position. And he even says, I don't even know if we should be absorbing all people into this form of theater because maybe it's reverse colonialism. I don't know. He's very specific. He's seeing life from that.
What do you think about reverse colonialism as an idea?
Very crazy. To me, it's when he said that, I was like, wow, this is like that book.
But there is a sense if you pay attention to the art world right now, whether it be in theater, film, I mean, even the presenters at the Oscars, everybody is making it somewhat of an intention to include,
trying to try
and be diverse, at least on the face of what they do.
On the face of it. Yeah. I think the Oscars are trying to because now the head is a woman of color. So she's actually making real change, I feel, or trying to push for that. And then there's other things like you can tell when it's the lens is just like, we got to check the box. It's usually people that don't really aren't from those communities that are like, okay, got to fill in, you know,
when it becomes obvious, yeah, it's
not,
difficult.
And it also doesn't attract the community of which you are trying to appeal to and invite in. A lot of our systems are changing now. Hollywood has to change because look at the biggest movies. No one's going to see a Julia Roberts movie anymore.
Right.
They're seeing co-pros around the world with real multi diverse casts and countries collaborating on stuff. Those are the big ticket movies.
Yeah.
You know, and so the people in power are like, oh geez, economically that's what people we've got to change. And so I think there is change happening, but it also requires what's different in the privates. If you don't deliver, you're fired. In public, you can hang on to your territory for a very long time. You can hang there for a long time and not necessarily deliver and not necessarily enact what your responsibility is as a public broadcaster.
And so
it does require some of those people just to give up responsibility. Like with Matthew, he's like, yeah, I'm kind of out of touch, you know, and now I'm stepping away and passing it to somebody else. And it's going to be full of conflict and difficulty, but I'm going to.
And by deliver, do you mean it's got to make a return on dollars or?
In the private world, it would be dollars. You'd gauge it by dollars. But you can also look
attendance.
By listenership.
Right.
A lot of the places, even I see theater that's a theater, some of the older art forms, CBC, many places, their listenership, their viewing audience, they're dying. They're older people. They're older white audiences.
Right.
And if they want to keep viable, they do have to bring in new people, you know, appeal to some of these cultural conversations or else they're going to go away. Like, who's going to want, like, but they don't quite know how to. And maybe if they actually hire people in positions of power that know how to access communities in real ways.
So that's the theme that comes up over and over again. If we put those people in those positions of power, not just as performers
not
or
just
not.
Because you're a tick box by somebody else who's like, hey, yeah, we need this guy here because he's like, whatever. And then put him in or put her in. It doesn't work that way.
But it's messy because I know so many people who've tried to hang on to that older, aging, predominantly white audience. And they are struggling, or maybe not even trying at all to pick up the next generation.
Yeah, sometimes they don't care. And like, I feel like, especially if you're a public broadcaster, if you're hired by Canadian taxpayers, you have a service.
Yeah.
You have a responsibility. You can't just be cushy cozy in your fiefdom and not making a visionary decision.
I thought it was interesting shortly after I saw your piece that Donald Trump signed an executive order suggesting that more people are going to be allowed to safely speak in universities and colleges in the States. And I think he was looking to protect, you know, conservative voices. And that's happened very recently.
I mean, it's so interesting how it's all been like, it's like Animal Farm. Everything's inverted.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think, you know.
But you speak to some artists in your piece who are sort of the millennial mm-hmm. age, and they talk about how, yes, indeed, some ideas should be censored. And I thought that was a very thoughtful part of the program because it really got me thinking, wow, this is a big conversation amongst younger people right now.
Absolutely.
Comedians are having trouble with younger people right now.
Yeah.
We're seeing a big
They're born
change
into
there.
A world that's full of upheaval. They've inherited a really screwed up place.
Yeah.
And they're seeing their peers, their friends being turfed out of America because they don't quote unquote belong in America or whatever.
Sure.
A lot of tumultuous things, conflicts of extremities, fundamentalism, conflict, environmental degradation, conflict. And they're like, so you understand it's a generational thing. It's like Matthew Jocelyn is the same generation as Robert Lepage, you know, regaled Canadian theater maker who came up with Kanata and Slav. You know, a Slava based upon the African-American, you know, struggle in Canada and Quebecois history and so forth. But he didn't hire any African-Canadian actors. And in Kanata, Indigenous relationships between the government of Canada and Indigenous populations and peoples, and no one, not one Indigenous actor. So, you know, Robert Lepage would say, hey, it's my freedom to do that. And like Matthew Jocelyn, they both come from like they came from a a struggle when they were young people. It was like all about freedom, 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 freedom. And those, some of those struggles were really, really important for you know, many, many social movements were rendered from the 60s hippies that wanted power and freedom for people.
And we think of Robert struggling through Quebec in the 50s and 60s, with very much its own struggle. And Matthew certainly with his own big ideas that he's trying to share with the world. But
no. And then so some of the millennials, specifically Zoe Voss and Ben Camino, two dancers, are like, yeah, when we heard about that, we're like, screw that shit. I'm signing this thing to shut it down. So it's like, is it censorship or is it just free to say, hey, I don't dig what you're doing and I think what you're doing is wrong and I'm not going to support what you're doing. I'm not going to give you my dollar. And so what happened was producers started to see, oh, okay, people aren't really liking that. And it's people's choice. It wasn't like a government sanction, like, boom.
Yeah.
It was more like, okay, use your dollar, use your ability to protest if you wish so to incline and consequences will occur. I mean, he's going to continue to remount them. And now Robert Lopez says he's going to reconsider Slav. And then we have George Eliot Clark weigh in and say, well, if you're going to reconsider it, just don't like pop it off like easy peasy. Just hire a few black actors.
Don't just check the box.
Don't just check the box. Do your due diligence. Do it right. And then so he brings up an interesting thing that is different from this juncture in time. When before it was like, hey, if I want to, you know, write for a black character, I will. Darn it, I've got the freedom to do that. Now it's like people are saying, maybe the people that experience the story should be able to tell the story. Maybe as a person, you're free to do whatever you want.
Of course, at your own peril, though.
At your own peril.
Yeah.
But you better probably do it with the due diligence and get the right, you know, your facts straight.
A lot of wokeness going on. People are woke all over the darn place.
And it's hard too, though, because, you know, I think censorship will never go away in you know, whatever that is just like, it's also people just sort of like online and so forth now have the liberty to speak out about the things that they're unhappy with. At the same time, it also cuts both ways because we're very, very heightenedly aware of this need to proffer a perfect online self-portrait. And we all see all of our friends and family members and all kinds of people getting called out and suffering the consequences. So it almost makes many of us more reluctant to speak out.
Yeah, it does. In fact, we had DJ Scratch Bastin on the show about 5 weeks ago, and he sort of echoed your sentiment, which is, you know, when you've watched other kids go get lambasted for whatever, and suddenly you realize this huge part of your identity, which is social media, and you have to censor yourself all the time just so you don't face that backlash. What a strange world to grow up in and something that to deal with.
And we can't, like, everyone's talking, but nobody ever talks very, very, very seldom about sex. It's still so taboo.
It really is.
We never do that and we never show ourselves looking ugly or boring and annoying. That's too much of a risk.
Yeah, I'm a real rock star on my social media. I don't know about you. But.
You're just as Indiana Jones, aren't you?
I'm looking good over there. I'll say that much. Well,
I know,
sometimes
it's troubling because I think it is inducing a very confused and anxious space and alienating. Like it's great that we're talking through all these media, but it's also weird that we're not sharing space. I mean, I really never really thought of theater as my go-to medium. I do dance and sort of impressionistic poetic performances. I go to it for more of a expressive, non-narrative expression. But this is the first time I've done a play, a narrative play. And I do find it interesting. Like before I had a great resistance to it, I would be like, I would never write anything that took place in a set of a kitchen or a living room,
right?
Like a domestic situation. If I did that, it'd be like in a movie where I feel like more of a suspension of disbelief. But I did jump at this because I do think that it is crucial and a beautiful place to share face-to-face time.
It really is.
But I think
Berkeley Street Theater.
I think there's a kind of like possibility of theater, not doing Ain't Misbehaving or all of those old-timey stuff, but maybe using it for the energetic utility of bringing people together who need to be together.
You definitely took a real, you know, plunge into to playing around with the idea and with the format and all of it.
It's like the reviews are in and it's like I'm batting 50-50. People love it or they're like, this is not a play.
Right.
It is so rough.
Yeah.
It's so ugly. Why are the videos so ugly? Some people are like that. Or like, well, I don't get it.
But it's like the same. It's like the old idea, right? You know, we look back at the Best Picture winners during the Oscars. And there's some years you look back and you go, whatever. Like, who even remembers that movie? That was such a boring movie and that was a bad pick. And then there's other times where you go, yeah, they really got it right. That's the one I remember from that year. You know, that's the one.
And then
one
you look
that,
back and all the critics hated it.
Right.
Like Cassavetes movies were always killed.
Right. And but regardless, I think the measure has to be, did I walk out of there and think about it for the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I had
and
to,
reference it as life went on. And I think I will always do that with,
oh,
your,
that's awesome,
with your piece.
I love that. I mean, it was a thorny, many tentacled beast that I had to, like, I was still writing by the time we hit rehearsals. By the time I changed it every night, I added a new sentence last night. You know, so it
you've
is.
Got,
a,
you've got the ability to do that.
Yeah, I'm the playwright, so I can.
But not
now
just,
my director is not there, so I'm like, oh.
But God. Even formatically, too, that you, it's just, it leaves you a little bit of wiggle room to play with it, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's exciting. And I mean, call-outs are just criticism, right? So, I mean, I feel that through this process, I'm just having to galvanize my sense of like, okay, be okay.
Yeah.
Let people be.
Yeah.
Let people be in all of their whatever.
And even during your talkbacks, I mean, you want to talk about critics. I mean, people are getting in your face about some of the things they've just seen. So you're just receiving it right away.
I am. You know? Yeah, for sure.
Right, like, off the bat. People have had 30 seconds to.
Yeah, and then I'm like, well, what do you think? And they're like, huh, what? I'm like, but, yeah, what do you think about
but kudos
that?
To
I
the,
love that.
Kudos to the arts world, right? I mean, people sometimes say, well, look at all the changes that are happening in our theaters on the big screen.
In our media,
and it's happening, and I think it might have been a little jarring for a certain part of the populace at a certain point, but I think people are adjusting, and it would be, once again, it's the artists leading the way, and in one format or another, moving this conversation along, and as difficult as it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Thank goodness, as artists, we have this ability to express ourselves. It's such a life-giving thing. At the same time, we do put our ass on the line.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I'm looking for my next gig.
I was thinking,
you know,
about
I
that.
Mean, I'm a freaking freelancer now.
Yeah.
You know, so I get to interview Ai Weiwei coming up. That's going to be really freaking awesome.
I just saw his bicycle exhibit down in, they've got it up in Austin right now for South by Southwest.
Oh, yeah?
It is unbelievable. You got to see this thing.
I'll look that up.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm excited to speak with him. Again, a person precariously working within a very confining box, you know. I did find that with this thing, too.
Sure.
You know, you are a box tick, perhaps.
Yeah.
But you can subvert that freaking box. There's a lot you can. People always like say, "Get out of the box." Sometimes it's like you don't have a door out of the box, just like your jail cell. So you better like imagine something and like redefine that box and use the power within the box to shift the whole conversation around. That's what I was hoping. And Ai Weiwei, I think he is very well aware of the constraints of the Chinese government upon his work.
Yeah.
He's now living in exile, but he is also that it doesn't. It's not like he was a free guy.
So fascinating
he's
man.
Working within that structure.
Have you gone to see that Gardner exhibit? I haven't gone to see it yet. He's got an exhibit here right now at the Gardner Museum.
I did see photographs of it, but right. I saw a larger one, a larger instance. It's the sunflower seed one.
The sunflower seed one is here right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've got to go.
But I mean, so there we are. You know, the artists are, they are forging ahead, but they are at peril. It's, you know, when I grew up, it was like to be an artist was a sacred undertaking. It was like a calling. We're like spiritual people, philosophical people. And now I'm like, if I was a young person today, no, I'd go into IT. Are you crazy?
Let's make some money here.
Yeah.
Are you prepared for a little rapid fire?
Sure.
Okay. So I don't know if this message was relayed to you, but we tried to do a little list. Thought I'd ask you 5 pieces of art. It could be any format. It could be a musician, a piece of theater, a visual artist, what have you, that were benchmarks for you, that changed your perspective, that you remember as being very, very important in your experience and helped to define, you know, your path forward.
Let's see. I think probably The Plague by Albert Camus. So when I was 15, I had previously been much more of a suburban kid when I was 14. And then I ran into the only punk in my small town. And he gave me a bunch of existentialist books and post-punk albums.
Good to have that guy.
And that blew my brain out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, definitely Albert Camus' account of rat infestation and people unable to leave their city during war because of the infestation being a kind of analogous to World War II was very deeply penetrating to me.
Isn't it wonderful when we're kids, too, how we can truly love, you know, a piece of art that gets thrown our way, a book or a movie can be so,
it's so
game-changing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it is so
Another
nutritious.
Another game-changer was Repulsion by Roman Polanski. Again, I was a child TV addict looking at TV shows, kids' shows, cartoons, and then blam, holy smokes, what is this going on? Catherine Deneuve is a young woman trapped in her house, imagining these horrible machination nightmares of like rabbits full of maggots and uncertainty and like her being a beautiful woman in society and feeling assailed by men. I turned that channel so quickly. I was like, yike. But then my child imagination was like, what is going on there?
Yeah.
And I turned back and I stuck with it. And I must have been like 8 or 9. And I could very much identify with the existential crisis this young woman was going through. And it was, again, something, a light.
That is mind-blowing to think of an 8-year-old being able to attach.
We know. We're like, that's the thing is kids are stealth. They look so cute, uh-huh. but they're highly, highly advanced beings, especially newborns. They're on this whole other level.
Yeah.
They look cute. And, you know, we're programmed to like look at them and want to protect them because they're like all soft and gushy and stuff. But they're such sentient high-level beings. Boop, 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 boop,
there was
boop,
a baby
boop, boop,
sitting there when you came in. I don't know. Did you see that baby?
I didn't see that
yeah,
baby.
Yeah, it was really cute.
Oh, my God. Well, that baby's like, I am taking everything in.
Full sponge, in effect. All right, number 3.
Let's see. Probably Susie and the Banshees.
It's great.
Love that. From the cradle past comes a beckoning voice that sends you spinning. You have no choice.
I can see it.
Following the footsteps of a ragdoll, down to your entrance, spell. Okay, yeah, that was in the group, and I'm up to 3.
I'm really nuts for that Sirius Satellite Channel First Wave, and so they just play. That's all
wow,
the kind of music
so
they
cool.
play, and I love it. Yeah.
Dream of the Red Chamber, a Chinese classic. So amazing, a beautiful, beautiful book. An epic tale like no other. So you really get into the Chinese imagination, whereby generations of accounts occur, lives, families, relationships through relationships. And, you know, one of them is a rock that falls in love with a will-o-wisp, you know, interspecies connections
wow.
between plants and people and rocks and people that are meaningful. A total other sense of narrative that really was amazing.
I had Cameron Bailey on and we went through his top 3 films of all time or that had a huge effect on him. And it was fascinating to think about world cinema that way and the different ways we can tell stories
yeah,
in
really,
different parts of the world.
Really,
I love
beautiful.
It. Yeah.
And let me see.
Number 5, I think. This is it.
There's so many more.
I know.
But I mean, I love Dora Carrington's paintings. So Dora Carrington was a woman who was a painter in the time of like the Bloomsbury Group and was sort of a life mate of Lytton Strachey, who's a writer. And both of them were gay, but they had a very romantic, love-fueled relationship for their whole lives. Dora did extraordinary paintings. At that time, women were not taken seriously, so it was considered like crafty. Meanwhile, he's like regaling everybody with his stories and stuff in the background. Dora's going and finding abandoned homes in the countryside in England, refurbishing them, turning them into beautiful works of art, painting her friends, such a staggering amount of gorgeous work that in her lifetime were completely ignored and only posthumously appreciated. I think she's somebody that I really love.
Good list. Great list. Very thoughtful. I was so thrilled to see Unsafe, and I was so thrilled to know that you would be the final episode of this first season, and it really was a pleasure, and thank you, Sukhin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Thank you, Sukhin Lee. A great conversation. So glad we had a chance to speak. You can see her live at the Berkeley Street Theater through Sunday with Unsafe, CanadianStage.com for tickets. Thank you once again to our sponsors today, Kerner Hall at the Royal Conservatory of Music, Salter Street Brewery, Superframe Framing Services, and Red Eye Media. Really, I couldn't have done this first season without you. Thank you so much. And thanks to you. Thank you for checking out the show. It's meant a lot to me. You can always visit the website if you missed an episode, art@theendoftheworld.com. We're available on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. We're also on Facebook. Twitter is @artattheend, and my Instagram handle is @wigdad. And don't forget, you can check out my show, The Oasis, on the New Classical FM, weekdays 3 to 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 to 4 Pacific. That's at classicalfm.ca. And you can watch the broadcast live on YouTube, if you prefer, in Toronto on the FM dial 96.3, Cobourg at 103.1, and in Collingwood, Ontario, 102.9. Thank you for listening to Season 1 of Art at the End of the World. We will be back. We'll speak to you then, and for as long as we can.